your life is about selflessness.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
let me just say, it's 7 o'clock. We're talking. You, Treece Lead and Marjorie Moore here are talking, and T-Dub is engineering. This is Sunrise on WBAI at 99.5 FM. And I think what we'll do is we'll take a break, but I know people want to talk with you, Treece. So we're going to come back and invite you, lovely, lovely audience, to participate with us in this discussion. And let's find out some of those things that your parents said to you. Like
your statement in life.
Yeah, your statement in life, or I bet I'll slap the soup out of you. Okay, stay tuned, WBAI. Is here now. Good morning, Andrea. Sister from another planet. It's 7:03 here at WBAI 99.5 FM. And don't forget, folks, visit our website, WBAI.org. Go there, check it out, and support this radio station. It is a secure website. You can feel comfortable doing that. If you ever desire a copy of any of Sunrise's shows, you can get them by calling 1-888-31-RADIO. That's 1-888-31-RADIO. And of course, my email is wbaisunrise@aol.com. wbaisunrise, all one word, @aol.com. All right, now you're going to call in. Here we go. 212-209-2900 to speak with you, Treece and I. 212-209-2900. And you, Treece, why don't we just dig right in and
go right ahead.
Say hello to folks. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Cousin Sadie.
Hi. How are you doing?
Oh, trying to catch up with you because you've got everything I want.
And
I'm going to try. Now, I'm not taking time to talk. I physically can't make the night things, but I'm going to try the morning things. And I want to say, I'm able to say good morning to my beloveds. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Sadie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Great friend.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Wow. Hi.
Carol Taylor. Oh, my goodness. This is like a reunion on the air.
It certainly is. I wanted to say yesterday, but I didn't get in, it's quintessential radio you guys are doing. It is fabulous.
Well, thank you, Carol. How are you doing?
I also wanted to suggest a forum, six strong black women on race. And I heard you yesterday, Utrice,
yeah.
And you made my day. And I wanted to ask where I can find you, listen to you, hear you, because I learn from you all the time.
Right here.
Actually, one of the things that we're hoping that you can do, too, because I know you're very much involved, and that is this upcoming board meeting, which takes place beginning Friday and going all the way to Sunday.
At the Doubletree Hotel.
At the Doubletree Hotel.
47th and Broadway.
At least that's where it was when we last heard.
Yes.
Listen,
follow the dot.
You all know what's going on. I wanted to say yesterday, I wanted to tell you that Judge, was a Lemick Nelson thing?
Yeah.
Judge, and I wrote to Earl Caldwell and told him that, who is another lovely person. Judge David Traeger presided over the Lemick Nelson trial, but and the Charles Price, but. And the Rockaway Five, the or eight, the rapist cop Rodriguez trial.
That's right.
Uh-huh. So that you know, there is a connection that we need to make as people of color, connect the dots kind of thing.
Well, in fact, you know, you're a very good person because I said yesterday that the only public comment that I remember in terms of legal critique in the Nelson trial came from Alton Maddox.
Yes.
And these are some of the questions that he posed at the time, and these were the issues that were dismissed. But we see that, in fact, we are back again at the point of looking at how the criminal justice system functions and the double standard and the illegalities that occur routinely, the neat political arrangements between the legal structure and the political structure to produce a predicted and predictable result.
Well, that's absolutely so. And what seems to me to be the central issue in, everything that we as black people are dealing with in this country and around the world also, people of color, the issue with the judicial system has been, as long as I've been studying it, I went into the jury when they called me for jury duty. I said, I'm doing this under duress because unless, here I come, every single court participant is tested, we hope, with our racism, colorism quotient test, to see what kind of damage has been done to them by the imprints of a racist, colorist society first, before they're allowed to make decisions about people of color, all right? Then you never have a system that's really functioning equitably for people of color. Mm-hmm. The white supremacist acculturation and socialization has forced many people who are running different institutions in our society up against the wall. Well, what am I going to do? And what happens is we still are not dealing with the central issue of untreated racism, colorism. Mm-hmm. And you know that we have been trying with our Institute for, quote, interracial, end quote, harmony to get the police departments in this country to stop killing black African males, which, of course, is also the centrality, the issue of my little black book.
All right, Carol. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
But I just love you both, and I want you all, both of you, to remember that your parents did the best job they could do, my parents also,
yep.
And they have really succeeded because you two are quintessential people, not just quintessential radio.
My goodness.
And you too.
You
and
go.
What a way to start the day.
But Carol Taylor, we're going to have you there on Friday?
I am contemplating going, but I do not like crowds and pushy people and all that, because I start acting out if you're going to transgress. I am a real, as you know,
yes,
I'm a real fighter, and I don't stand fools lightly. I mean, if people are going to be pushing and shoving and coming up with nonsense,
yeah,
sometimes I absent myself. I haven't decided yet.
But it's worth observing. And it's we need you and others to act as independent observers.
All right,
of the process.
If you're saying you need me there,
yes,
I will be there.
Yes, we do.
I am not fearful. I'm not a person who is timorous. I respect both of you. And if you say you need me there, I shall be there.
We need you and others to be independent observers of this process.
Right. All right.
Thank you very much, Carol.
All right.
Thank you. All right, let's just move right along. Good morning. You're on the air. Your name, please, and where you're from.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's nice to hear two civil people. I heard somebody say, where is the location? And do you know it was changed? I myself played a little part. I tried to find venues where they could hold it. But it's now going to be at the restaurant and hotel.
That's
false information.
That's false information.
Thank you.
That's
good
false.
Morning. You're on the air. We're moving right along. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Marjorie. Good morning to you, Treece.
Good morning.
Yeah, this is Reverend Johnson on Staten Island.
Hi, right. Reverend Johnson.
I respect both of you, and, you know, I don't know what's really happening with the so-called dissidents, which I was one about 10 months ago.
Yes.
But I can tell you one thing is if one gets a concrete, cohesive corporate overstanding of the true social reality, it comes down to race.
Mm-hmm.
People do not want progressive blacks or progressive whites who have the BAI audience mind at the best level of what radio should be, and Utrice has demonstrated that. I don't agree with everything she has done, but on a scale of 1 to 10, she's a professional, and she's a person who looks out for professionalism,
mm-hmm.
intelligence, and she represents a black woman who wants to see not only her race progress, but other progressive people move on. Now, finding out race is the problem that we're dealing with.
Well, actually, I don't. The thing is, it is not nearly as simple as this. It is a very serious situation, and I would rather not tell you what it is. I would rather you observe for yourself what it is and come to your own conclusions. And I'm hoping that you and others will attend the board meeting, make a very strong effort to do so, and see the process itself. Participate as fully as you can, and don't depend on me to give you to tell you what the situation is. I'm not going to do that. I am relying on the fact that you have a working brain in your head, you have eyes that you can see, as they say, and you can hear for yourself, and you can assess the situation yourself. You'll be able to do that. And the best possible evidence will be the evidence that you will be presented with yourself.
That has really been your approach throughout the last year.
Yes.
It has been, people keep saying, well, why don't you tell us what happened? Tell it, you know.
Yeah.
And Utrice is continually stated this view that she just presented, that it's much better when you experience things for yourself and reach your own conclusion.
Come to your own conclusion.
We're not here to tell you what to think. We're here to hopefully facilitate your observation of things, provide information, but not to shove opinions down your throat.
I'm not interested in
no,
that.
You're not.
I wouldn't allow it for myself. I don't like people telling me what to think.
You've been very clear, and people think, well, you're being so passive about everything that's going on. No, it really wasn't passive. It was so that people can gather their own conclusions, reach their own, observe the situation, watch what's going on, read the things, learn how to read the things that are mm-hmm. being presented to you, that they're one-sided.
You come and see for yourself.
Come and see.
Look at the conduct. Mm-hmm. Look at the scenario. Understand. Be your own good journalist. And I like that, the
yes.
idea that you be your own investigative reporter. Come in and conduct your own investigation yourself. Query for yourself. Ask questions yourself. Introduce yourself to the people who you think are important to know. Ask them questions. Subject them to scrutiny and subject a process to scrutiny. Gain an understanding for yourself. This is your opportunity. Don't depend on me. I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to tell you what is the situation, because that's going to be a biased report and it's going to be from my vantage point. And I want you to be your own good journalist, because I said yesterday mm-hmm. that everybody is perfectly equipped, just as you are, to be a journalist. All you have to do is to observe, synthesize the information, ask proper questions,
mm-hmm.
and come to your own conclusions.
Take your own photograph.
Take your own
photograph. Those who have video cameras, videotape.
Come on in.
Come on in. Do your own documentary
yeah.
about the situation.
Truly participate in the democratic process.
If you're passionately concerned,
yeah.
these are the things you do. You document what's going on.
Yeah.
You gather the papers that are being handed out. Pick up things off the floor. I've done that. Posters and different things, and I have a record of several movements that I've been involved in. It's a do that, and then ponder it and think about your position.
That's right.
All right, let's take another call.
Thank you, Reverend Johnson.
Yes, thank
Good
you.
To hear from you.
Good morning. This is WBAI. I'm Marjorie Moore here with Utrecht Lead. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to say that, if anything, in retrospect, I know what the coup did for me. It helped filter out all these so-called progressives who felt free to call the radio station and call people nigger and nigger lovers. Just like I wouldn't want those people involved in a progressive radio station. Just as someone who would call in and have the nerve to call someone a hymie, I wouldn't want those people involved in a progressive radio station. So I now know, in the beginning I was confused, but now... That is what the coup has done for me. If those people were calling themselves aggressive, I want them filtered out.
All right. Do you mind telling us your name and where you're from?
Claudia from Manhattan.
Claudia?
Yes.
Hi, Claudia.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Yes. Will you come to the board meeting?
Yes, I am going. Are you kidding? Yes.
Very good. So we'll make yourself known. Say hello to us.
I will.
If you see us around.
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay.
Oh, and if old things are coming back, that means we get Utrecht back at all.
Well, we're not letting
you know, you know what I discovered? One of my statements in life is that I have a unique ability. My unique ability is to make other people shine. I've discovered that.
You do that.
I'm very good at helping people come into their fullness. I really am.
We're all walking around here with a golden glow.
Not really.
Shining away. No,
I'm very, very good at that.
Well,
you
hey,
are.
The old people coming back. I'm looking back for the old talk back.
Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you very much.
All right. WBAI, good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Hi. Good morning, Marjorie.
Who's
and Utrecht.
Good morning.
Denise in Manhattan.
Hey,
what
Denise.
A wonderful, melodious voice you have.
Yes. Oh, and you know, I thought I was losing it. I was like, oh, my gosh. Utrecht,
yes.
I was at a meeting last night at UAM, and flyers were being passed out. So I'm kind of confused, and the flyer I have in my hand has a different location.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, so it's not a real one.
Well, the official notice that I'm aware of says that the meeting will occur at the DoubleTree Hotel.
Okay.
And
I have the workers, Local 6.
Yeah, no. the people are putting out all kinds of things.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's part. Look, we have lost track of all the different nefarious ways in which people are trying to dodge.
Wow.
You know, yesterday it was announced, and immediately that the people saying, "Well, the meeting is not occurring there; it's occurring here."
Right.
You know, it's to
scatter you, the community.
Okay. Because I was going to fax you this. They got a preliminary schedule. They got it.
They have all kinds.
Of Well, I'd love to. I'd love for you to fax me.
I think I will.
What is the fax number here, by the way? Does anyone know it? Maybe we'll get it.
Okay.
We'll get it in
You want me to call the board?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Would you? And okay. And put Marjorie on there.
Okay, they open at 9, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great,
Denise. You guys have a great day.
Thank you. And we need you and others, again, we need
out.
Some yes. independent observers of the process. Wherever the flyers say, we do know that the official meeting has been called at the Doubletree Hotel, 47th Street and 6th Avenue.
Okay.
And what we are hoping for is that our community, the people who have been doing the bulk of the work of supporting the station, the people who are pleased with the programming, the people who are very supportive of the elevation of the programming standard and what it is we're trying to accomplish, the people who have put their money where their minds are and kept the station going, that they will be the independent observers of this process, because we are hoping to call on you for your testimony as to what it is you have witnessed, your questions. We will analyze the events, what you have seen, what your opinions are, and therefore what is going on. We will piece the whole puzzle together based on your independent analysis.
Okay, can I share a real quick experience
yes.
I have?
Yes.
Not just past fundraiser, but like 2 fundraisers ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was there answering the telephone.
Oh.
And I've never in my life been called nigger as many times as I've been called in the name of Democracy Now.
Well, people would never believe this, but if I were to say it, they would not believe it. So I'm glad that you are saying it.
I was called everything. I was threatened. People told me Mamiya would not want you there. I have never seen that kind of craziness in my life.
Yeah, and believe it or not, that was just the beginning.
Yeah.
Some of us have literally been threatened with death.
I could imagine what you guys are going through,
This is the progressive community behaving
this
way.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were here.
And those are the things I personally experienced.
Yeah.
You know, I want to say that even in... Thank you, Denise, very much
thank
for that
call. Thank you
very much. I want to say, too, that even in the face of a brutal boycott of the pledge drive, in spite of that, the black and Latino community supported us to the tune of $1 million.
The truly progressive
yes.
white community.
That's right. And the progressive white community, the real progressive white community, that's right,
yeah.
that's a good way to put it, came through anyway.
And came through miraculously. We went way beyond our expectations.
That's right, we did.
Yeah.
It was just a beautiful... and that, you know, that drive will always mean... We could raise $10 million next week. That drive will always mean more to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that people had to break through obstacles. The phones were jammed. They were given... misinformation was passed out.
The volunteers were subjected to unbelievable...
Restaurants were told not to donate food for the volunteers.
Yeah.
And despite all of that, people came in here to volunteer. Listeners like you showed up. They were called all kinds of names and abused on the phones. And they just stuck with us and
yeah.
stayed cheerful and pulled us through. And that $1 million will always mean more to me.
And what a statement that makes about the state of people's minds in a progressive movement. Now, this kind of activity hasn't been directed at the Bush administration.
Right.
It hasn't
or
been
the Giuliani.
It hasn't been directed at the Ku Klux Klan. It hasn't been directed at the ultra right wing. It has been directed. Collections of progressive people behaving this way. Unbelievable.
Well, Treese, we're going to have to leave it there.
Oh, really? I protest.
Clayton Riley. will be coming up.
Oh, good. Marjorie, this is so wonderful to be with you. I feel, you know...
Well, this is good fun. And,
yeah.
You know, we have... Listen, folks, let me just take a minute to apologize. I try to get to the phones.
You know what we should do?
So many
we should do a program.
Speak.
Here's... You're right.
Yeah.
We should do a program in which we say absolutely nothing.
Right. Just take call. No, we should. Come in.
We don't say a word.
Well, you know, they're stimulated from 2 days of programming,
yeah.
and then they want to share, and then
yeah.
we don't have enough time. So maybe What's tomorrow's Friday?
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe we'll let you talk more Friday. Maybe we'll just say a few things about the meeting.
Okay.
And encourage people to come out. And really, you dear ones, you community that support us and love us, and you let us know that you care about us, we really need you now. We really need you to get it together for the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
To independently document what is going on Friday,
and
Saturday.
Bring friends, bring observers. Neighbors, help seniors even who
want to
come.
And be journalists. Bring your notebook, your notepad. Take notes. Take copious notes. Interview people who you observe as playing critical roles in whatever sphere.
Yes.
Get their words down, because you will be helping us formulate a document.
And that'll
and it would be a very important document that would have great clout, because it will be an independent assessment of what is going on. Again, we're taking very good care not to tell you what to think.
That's
we're not interested in formulating your opinion for you.
You will do that
For yourself.
Thank you so much, you truthfully.
Marjorie, thank you. My wonderful, wonderful sister and friend.
Absolutely.
And Andrea Clark.
Thank you, Andrea.
Today was Women's Day. We had T-Dub.
That's right. All women here this morning. All right.
All
now
great.
We're going to have a man. Clayton Riley is coming up with WBAI this morning. He and Paul DiRienzo. You got to stay tuned. Clayton is on the money.
He's on time.
He is on time. Our brother is on time.
He's on time.
And he'll be here in a minute. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Great love to you this morning. Great, great love.
Walk with me.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
To High Five, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
On Wall Street. Look sharp today, boys, especially you rookies.
WBAI. Clayton Riley here in the morning with you at 99.5 FM. This is Pacifica Radio from New York City. Upcoming conversation with State Senator David Patterson. You're hearing a little bit of Aaron Neville. Hopefully those of you who haven't wakened yet with Marjorie Moore and Chase this morning will wake at this point. Andrea Clark at the controls. We'll be with you until 10 o'clock this morning. And I'd like to advise you also, we're going to be talking to our station's general manager, Robert Daughtry, in a little bit. So stay tuned for that. And if all goes well, we may even hear from some of you as well. Let us now introduce you to, I dare say it, veteran State Senator David Patterson. Good morning, Senator Patterson. Hello.
Easy, Clayton.
How are you, man?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, yeah, I had to throw that a little bit in there because people should know that you have been fighting the good fight in our state Senate. How long is it, actually?
This is the beginning of my 17th year.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Let me ask you right on that point.
You know, I had a high school teacher. I saw him at a reunion, and I remember when he was in the high school, he said that he knew he'd gotten older when he first came to the school. If young people got into a fight, he knew the teachers who seemed to know how to resolve disputes, and he'd go out in the hall and he'd try to get next to them.
Uh-huh.
He said now he goes out in the hall and people try to get next to him. And that's when I really understand that I've been around a while, when people actually ask me what I think about this process.
All right. Good point to start with in our conversation this morning. When you were a freshman up there, it was, I would guess, one legislature, and it may be a very different one today. To give us some talking points on what it was then and what it's like now.
Well, actually, when I came to the legislature, I thought that from the progressive standpoint, that we were more active in those days. What I think has happened, and I'm certainly a part of it, is there's been an assimilation of black and Latino and even some progressive white legislators into leadership positions. And those leadership positions at times have, in my opinion, thwarted some of the true feelings that these members have, and you don't see the kind of strident, independent challenge to authority that you saw some years ago. And it culminated, I thought, in the state legislature with a very poor performance on our part during the Diallo trial in 1999, in 2000, where we basically just stood around and watched and were spending more time assuring public officials in the Albany area that there wouldn't be unrest, when in fact what we needed to be doing was talking about the circumstances that led that case to being moved to Albany. So I think that in some respects, we have not been replaced with some of the newer members showing the kind of conscientious objection that we did to a lot of the processes that are going on there. And although when one is in a leadership position, they're often constrained by a certain loyalty, at the same time, you are elected, if you're in the Assembly, by 140,000, and if you're in the Senate, by 300,000 constituents. And they did not elect you to have your voice in any way diminished by any sort of organizational or political process. And so that, to me, is a significant difference that I see in the legislature from the time that I came there.
Senator Patterson, there has been a perception, I think, and perhaps it functions upstate as well, but I think there is a perception downstate that New York is essentially split in half. There are upstate concerns and initiatives, and there are downstate concerns and initiatives. And, of course, if that is so, it would seem to me quite unfortunate because we are hopefully one state of people. But is that perception, in your judgment, at all accurate?
Well, I think that it was certainly a tension between the two regions that's existed over a period of time, culminating in 1969 when the writer Norman Mailer and the columnist Jimmy Breslin actually ran for mayor and city council president of New York, advocating that if they won, that they would fight to make New York City the 51st state.
Mm-hmm.
What I think has happened recently, and what I find truly fascinating, is that the upstate regions, particularly the Catskills, the Buffalo-Niagara Falls area, and even the Binghamton-Utica area, are experiencing some of the same problems that the downstate areas have had. Unemployment, poor educational facilities, lack of tourism, and lack of revenues. And so but in spite of the fact that they have the same problems, they don't seem to acknowledge that they come from the same sources. And so therefore, they look for remedial efforts from the state, as we do, but sometimes seem to almost imply that they have some sort of entitlement that we don't.
Hmm. I'm going to key on something you mentioned in that upstate-downstate issue, and that is education. Now, both you and I went to the New York City system. I went through grammar school, high school, began college here, later transferred. But I have to say to you that the system was so different at that time, and the system I see now. I go places all over the world and tell people that the educational system I enjoyed after the fact, you didn't enjoy it so much when you were sitting in the classroom perhaps, but later on you had a sense, hey, I got an education. I'm not so sure many kids can say that anymore, and the question is, what has happened? We spend an enormous amount of money, actually. I think the city budget is now up over $11 billion annually. Why is it we have such difficulty delivering an education to our children?
Well, as you probably know, Clayton, and if all the listeners don't know, there is a new city councilman who represents West Harlem and Inwood and Washington Heights. His name is Robert Jackson.
Yes.
And one of the things that propelled him to victory is that he was a part of a campaign for fiscal equity that was actually their name. And he sued the state based on the formula that dispenses resources into communities. And won. As a result of that, the state was ordered to balance the revenues going into particular areas. Now, what always happens whenever you raise this is that someone comes forward and says that pouring money into educational systems doesn't work. Well, as a general statement, that's probably true, but interestingly enough, the eight poorest performing school districts in the state are also the eight least funded. So it certainly has something to do with it, and that's probably why the people who get the money are so happy to make sure that by a few percentage points that the upstate regions receive more resources than the downstate. What is really disturbing is that after September 11th, and for those who aren't aware of this, we had passed on August 2nd of last year what they call a bare-bones budget. In other words, we passed enough of a budget to pass a court challenge and legal muster, and we could go on with government as an efficiency budget, but had not passed the appropriation of revenues. And when September 11th came to shorten it, the federal government basically said to us, any surplus that you have, and the Democratic Party thought there were $2.1 billion in surplus, the Republican Party thought there were $1.5 billion in surplus, but the federal government has said to us, if you want federal money to participate in the recovery, you then have to devote all of your resources, all of your surplus to that effort. So when we did that in October, and the education formula for this particular year is just to almost thumb our noses, thumb ourselves in the face of that court decision, the distribution of funding to the downstate region as opposed to the upstate was four times wider apart than it had been even before the court decision. So it's just interesting how antagonistic government is even to court tests. Then I think that just generally when I think in terms of education, what I've always thought is that you, and I am a person who was educated in public school, was one of the first students to ever be educated in the classroom with other students. I have a legal disability. I'm legally blind. And what I always remembered about my personal education is I did only as well as the teachers believed in me. And I think that this is not a comment about the teachers. It's really just a comment about the entire system. I don't think that we have, in short, built our educational system around a surety that the young people who go through the system can go on to become very successful people to add to our workforce and contribute to the inertia of our society. I don't find that. I don't hear any executives talking about the great ability of the students in the New York City public school system. And yet, when you go and you see them, they do have it.
Senator Patterson, when we talk about the upstate regions losing their economies or seeing their economies break down, is that simply because jobs are being shifted elsewhere? I mean, there was a time when we thought of the upstate regions of New York as a solidly working class towns where there were, in a sense, always jobs for people who wanted to work. That apparently is no longer true. What has happened to that part of the economy?
Well, New York State has, as you point out, Clayton, lost a great number of jobs. And in terms of job creation, there are 10 counties in New York State, 10 of them, whose largest revenue raiser is the corrections industry. The corrections population, which was 12,385 30 years ago, has sextupled, and that's not a word that was an outgrowth of the impeachment hearings. That is six times the amount. And we have over 80,000 inmates in our state prisons. And Governor Pataki did mention for the second time in a State of the State message yesterday reforming the Rockefeller drug laws, because half the people in prison never committed a violent crime. They're there for possession of substances. And while, as you know, a society, we would encourage people to refrain from that, I don't know that carrying a prison sentence and giving them a long-term stigma is the answer to that particular question. So when we talk in terms of job creation in those particular areas, we have to find other means rather than depending on building prisons and having seven assembly districts, in a sense, provide the economic relief for a whole upstate region. You know, when they first started to put prisons in those areas, communities used to fight it. Then the deals that were made, where you had almost entire towns where everybody either works at the facility or is involved in some kind of commercial endeavor that brings supplies to the facility, you have a situation where, although people say they want crime to go down, that's the reason why when crime dropped off in the last few years, you're hearing about the abolition of parole, and you're hearing about the desire not to to lengthen sentences for crimes that we've had sentence guidelines for years, because those areas, while they might not really even recognize it publicly, need for there to be enough inmates to keep the facilities going. So you've got a situation where the institution is actually almost perpetuating crime, because if you had a significant crime decrease, you would have economic problems for these regions. And in some cases, that's actually already happened.
What do you think about the State of the State address? This, of course, is the year of the gubernatorial election. And I ask about the State of the State speech in terms of what you feel will be its impact on that race.
Well, Governor Pataki talked about a number of programs and ideas, such as the reform of the Rockefeller drug laws, although that's what he said last year, and then the devil was in the details. What he talked about as reform was really, you know, very slight changes in those laws that the advocates firmly opposed. But what I would say is that there's talk of him working out a resolution with some of the unions, particularly the hospital workers, and perhaps there's a feeling that Governor Pataki would like to try to bring resources to New York City to help the negotiation that the teachers union is involved in right now, and certainly hospital workers and teachers are strong professions who need to be paid for the work that they do. And if he does that, then the State of the State message was highly political, because it would be very difficult, and I say this as a Democrat and someone who will be opposing Governor Pataki, hopefully behind Controller Carl McCall and this fall, but it will make it more difficult for him to be dethroned. Interesting enough, this is the same governor who argued that no one should run for more than two terms and objected to Governor Cuomo's running for a fourth term, and then somehow he's now running in his third term. Just thought I'd point that out for those who were keeping score. But what has struck me since September 11th, and there was certainly a lot of evidence in this, in the State of the State address, is the tremendous lack of adherence to the goals and to the principles that people who have somewhat of a conservative ideology said they always believed in. Now, as you remember, Clayton, we right now have organized six facilities around the state to accommodate casino gambling.
Yes.
And there's also opportunity for a constitutional amendment that would allow gambling in the state. The six facilities are run by Native Americans on sacred soil. But there's a move afront to actually change the constitutional amendment to allow casino gambling around the state. And from the point of view of just people being allowed to exercise free choice, I'm not commenting necessarily on whether or not they should be gambling. But I do think that there are two types of personalities who do go to the casinos. There's the people who go on vacation, they take a couple hundred dollars, they go and play the slot machines or something, then the money runs out, and then they go do something else. Then there are the people who are habitual gamblers who tax our social service systems, who are desperate people. And I just simply ask the question, which of the personalities did the state display when we had always not allowed for these gambling facilities, and then all of a sudden, after September 11th, within 1 month, allowed for six new facilities and for a constitutional amendment to possibly be passed in order to bring gambling to New York. The state was acting in desperation, and all the people who had traditionally been opposed to it, suddenly, because we had an economic problem, totally changed their ideologies. And I thought that was one of the saddest commentaries on the performance of elected officials that I have ever seen in my tenure, which you now say is veteran.
More than 30 years ago, there was the fight, and essentially, I believe, an upstate-downstate fight about the establishment of off-track betting parlors. And particularly upstate, they argued that even if we do have these things, they can't be open on Sunday. There were other restrictions. And at that time, I think the impetus for the victory on the part of people who wanted to have off-track betting was that these revenues would end up in our school system and therefore improve it. Some people would say, well, if that was the measure that we were to have in terms of off-track betting, has any of that happened? Has any of that revenue had an effect on our school system?
Well, studies have shown that not a great deal of the money ever got to the school system, and it's really funny that the same regions around the state who laughed at inner cities who pleaded for money years ago to eradicate poor housing and substance abuse and crime and poor and inadequate health care facilities are now in such desperation that I suggest that right after casino gambling, they'll lower the drinking age to 14, and then they can raise some more money for their areas.
Oh, my. You know, I just want to close up. We're moving into our newscast, but let me say, first of all, it's been a great pleasure having this opportunity to talk to you. Don't be a stranger, man. I really, you know, I've always enjoyed talking to you.
And, yeah, Clayton, we have to...
We got to make that a regular date. Let me just share this story with you. You may know about it. Hazel Dukes, when she was head of the Off-Track Betting Corporation in New York, had made a plea to the parlors to take what is called action on multiple tracks around the country. And at that time, in the beginning of off-track betting, we had the New York track every day, and on the day that we didn't have racing in New York, we took one other track. Hazel said, look, with modern technology, and particularly our capacity with television, we could take bets from all over the country. There were three tracks running simultaneously in California, two in Florida, Arlington Park and Chicago. And they all said, no, you can't do that. The bettors will be confused. Well, if you know anything about bettors and horse parlors, you could splash a pail of water on the wall. They'd bet which drop got to the floor first. There's no confusing of bettors. As much action as available, they'll take it. They argued Hazel down and said, no, this would never work. The moment Hazel Dukes was out of office, let me let you guess what happened.
It's all over the place.
We take action from every track in the world, Hong Kong, Japan, Australia, everywhere.
Well, I can understand why those people were a little jealous of Hazel's proposal, because they bet it wasn't going to work.
Yes, indeed. That's exactly what they said. This will never work. The bettors will not be able to handle it. They won't be able to keep track of which track is running. She understood something. And incidentally, not as a person who came out of the industry, but she just understood something, I say, perhaps intuitively, about what would make that system work. Senator Patterson, I want to thank you very much for your time this morning. You're an early bird today, man. This is...
Clayton, you inspire me,
okay,
as you did when you interviewed me 10 years ago, and you haven't lost that magnitude.
Okay, man. Listen, we will talk again soon, yeah?
Thank you very
and
much.
And listen, let me pass along to you kudos to your staff. Wonderful bunch of people. They did a great job in keeping all this on track for us to be together this morning. Give them all a raise.
They're very talented, and they're overpaid.
Okay. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
All right. This morning continues here at WBAI 99.5 FM. Here's Paul DiRienzo with the news. Paul?
Thank you. Good morning, Clayton. A military team is headed from Afghanistan to the site of a military plane crash in Pakistan. A Marine spokesperson says they're going to do everything to find out what caused the crash. All seven Marines on board were killed. Harsh terrain is hindering recovery efforts. Tom Ridge says the 2002 Winter Olympics will be a fan-friendly venue despite the tight security. The Homeland Security Director spoke to the morning talk shows from Salt Lake City, where he's reviewing security procedures. He says signs of protection will be visible. And the Army will inscribe Green Beret Sergeant Nathan Chapman's name on a memorial to fallen soldiers today at Fort Lewis, Washington. Chapman was gunned down last week. He's the first U.S. soldier killed by enemy fire in Afghanistan. Not at least as been reported by the media and by the news at this point in the United States government. Nine people killed when a U.S. sub rammed into a Japanese fisheries boat off the coast of Hawaii last year were remembered at a memorial service today. More than 1,000 people turned out for the ceremony at the boat's home port in Japan. Eight of the bodies have been recovered. And with the flick of a wrist, a growing number of college students are racking up thousands of dollars in debt. A third of students have four or more credit cards, and a Harvard study says bankruptcies filed by the under-25 crowd hit a record in the year 2000. And Tom Ridge says despite the tight security, as we reported earlier, the 2002 Winter Olympics will be fan-friendly. The Homeland Security Director spoke, as we said, to the morning talk shows from Salt Lake City, where the Olympics are being held, and he is reviewing security procedures. He says that federal, state, and local officials have done everything humanly and technologically possible to prepare for any kind of terrorist attack, and Ridge says that includes a chemical or biological attack. He says federal officials extended a terror alert they issued in early December until March to remind everyone to be alert through the Super Bowl and the Olympics. And federal regulators say that two nuclear fuel rods missing from the Millstone complex in Waterford, Connecticut, were not stolen. The Nuclear Regulatory Agency says the fuel rod, while still not accounted for, were not stolen from the plant. The NRC also says that the rod's low uranium and plutonium content means they could not be used to construct a nuclear weapon. There will be a public meeting at the Millstone plant next week to discuss the agency's examination of Northeast Utilities' 10-month search for the rods. Northeast Utilities first reported the fuel rods missing to federal regulators in December of 2000. The fuel rods were last verified to be in the reactor's spent fuel pool in 1980. The company NU has concluded that the fuel rods were likely mistaken for old monitoring equipment cut up and shipped to low-level radioactive waste dumps or could still be in storage in Millstone. A small contingent of New York police detectives is headed to Afghanistan to question prisoners captured by American forces in the war on terrorism. That's according to Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly, who traveled to Haiti to set up the police department there and do the same thing there, as I remember. Kelly tells the Daily News that officers assigned to the Joint Terrorist Task Force will be flown to Afghanistan. He declined to discuss specifics or disclose how many officers were headed to the country. More than 300 Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners under U.S. control already are being interrogated by CIA, FBI, and military officials. It's a little late. I hate to be commentary, but Michael Levine, who is a commentator here and has a show, has spoken to how long it took them to hand over investigations of potential terrorist attacks in New York to NYPD, who actually are much better ready or much more prepared to do this kind of work than the FBI obviously showed themselves to be. And I just had to comment that while we were talking about it. Documents that helped convict Nazi war criminals are now just a click away on the Internet. They began appearing today at the Rutgers Journal of Law and Religion site at www.lawandreligion.com. The first set of documents lays out a Nazi plan to eliminate Christianity and convert its followers to an Aryan philosophy. More documents will be posted every 6 months with commentary from scholars. The documents are taken from 148 volumes of personal papers and records kept by General William Donovan. He was the leading U.S. investigator during the Nuremberg trials, the founder of the OSS, which became the CIA. The documents gathered dust for decades until a New York lawyer recognized their importance. The cache includes transcripts in German and English, as well as background memoranda and evidentiary analysis. And New York Governor George Pataki delivered his State of the State address yesterday. Speaking before a joint session of the legislature, the governor asked New Yorkers for patience as the state recovers from the economic aftermath of the September 11th World Trade Center attacks. Even though some analysts say the state's economy was headed downhill even before September 11th, WB